On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Chinese President Hu Jintao hits the road in Africa today for an eight-nation tour, just the latest in a flood of exchange between China and the world's poorest continent. Across Africa today, Chinese crews are building railroads and schools, roads and bridges and hospitals and fiber optics. They're pulling out mountains of minerals and oceans of oil to feed China's roaring economy. They're raining billions on cash-starved Africa. But they've also provided the helicopter gunships that terrorize Darfur, the shiny blue tiles that decorate the roof of Zimbabwean dictator Robert Mugabe's house, and the diplomatic cover that keeps bad actors in power. Up next on Point, China in Africa and the new face of global power. We will hear many voices this hour from Africa and beyond, but we begin in this globalized era in central India. Simon Robinson is Time Magazine's newly appointed South Asia bureau chief, on the job there. But until just 2 months ago, he was in Johannesburg as bureau chief, covering Africa since the late 90s. He did much of the reporting for a recent article in Time called China Takes on the World. Simon Robinson, watching Africa from India, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
Simon, take us, if you would, into the back roads of Africa and the kind of Chinese presence that has grown so markedly there in recent years. What do you see? What's going on?
It is an incredible change over the last even half decade. In cities across Africa, you notice a lot more Chinese restaurants. You notice Chinese doctors, clinics. On the plains of Sudan, there are Chinese pumping oil out. There are Chinese into oil in the Delta in Nigeria. There are Chinese mines in Congo. There are Chinese oil workers, again, in Angola. There seem to be, everywhere you go these days, there are Chinese both diplomats and business people on airplanes and in bars and in hotels. It's a fairly incredible change. I moved to Africa in the early 1999, and while there were a few Chinese around, really the difference now is quite incredible. What's happened basically is that in the 50s and 60s, China was a pretty close friend to some African countries, and during that period of African independence, got very close to, in particular, states like Tanzania, which were trying what they called a type of African socialism. And China moved in and was helpful in both the liberation struggle in many cases, but also in building things that new countries might need, like big airports or train systems or sports stadiums. But it was a fairly kind of an ideological relationship. China got out of it, I guess, support at the UN and also recognition over Taiwan from the African nations, and African nations got a few baubles to kind of show off. Then in the 70s, late 70s, 80s, into the 90s, there was really a withdrawal by China from Africa. And over the last few years, though, they've come back, and it's a much, much more commercial relationship. China's basically looking at Africa as a place, as you mentioned, for a lot of minerals and oil, probably above all else. And they're in there in a very big way, both at a government level and companies, often driven by cheap loans from the Chinese government to these companies. So trade is booming. Africa and China trade is up about 400% over the past 5 years, and it's set to double again by 2010.
Well, Simon, let me ask you, if I may, Simon. Of course, there are a lot of European companies in there as well, and government agencies, and American companies and government agencies. Are China's projects today different in kind or in impact from those of Western powers?
The Chinese and some African officials would argue, yes, that the Chinese are much kind of closer to the kind of quiet diplomacy that Africa often prefers. and so they won't often attach various conditions to loans and to projects. So so it's possible, yes, that the Chinese projects there are a little different. They also tend to be much more forward thinking and long. They plan for the longer term much more. So they have their horizon for various projects and for the returns on those various projects are kind of 20 or 30 years, often not the 5 years that Western companies might do.
And Simon, we've heard two lines of criticism. One, that China will lend money and start projects anywhere they like, whether or not there's corruption involved. They don't seem to mind. That is a line of criticism. And two, that their sort of human rights or democratic awareness is very low. If they want to do business with Sudan, never mind that Darfur goes on. They're not going to be critical of the African governments they're dealing with. Are these fair criticisms?
Yeah, I think that especially the second one rings true in places like Sudan, where obviously there's a what the U.S. has called and various human rights groups call a genocide going on in Darfur. The Chinese government is very close to Khartoum and has regularly blocked more serious sanctions on Sudan at the United Nations. Obviously, as a permanent member of the Security Council, they're able to do that. Also in places like Zimbabwe, I mean, China is very close to Harare and has basically bailed out Robert Mugabe, who's a fairly ruthless dictator, over the last few years, and in return has got a lot of land, actually, a lot of business in Zimbabwe, so much so that a lot of average Zimbabweans are very, very resentful about Chinese influence in Zimbabwe and just see it as a way for Mugabe to stay in power.
And Simon, let me ask you finally, China is big and booming and getting bigger. Does it matter anymore what anybody else thinks of China's relationships in Africa? Does it matter what the U.S. or Europe or a U.N. agency may think? Is this off on its own steam now?
I think that's a really interesting question, and I think that we've reached a point in China's kind of geopolitical development where we have to ask those questions and suddenly kind of recognize that China is a player. You know, for years and years, I guess the two superpowers were the Soviets and the U.S. and China and Africa really benefited in many ways, especially democratically, from the demise of the Soviet Union and the end of the Cold War. Now there's another player. Some of the same criticisms are being thrown against it, but it's so big that it doesn't really matter. And maybe Africa is the first kind of area in the world where we're seeing the assertion of Chinese power, and we're not really able to do a whole lot about it.
Simon Robinson, a longtime Johannesburg correspondent for Time magazine, with us today from central India. Ain't we global? Simon, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
I want to turn now to Africa and Togo, Lomé, Togo, where we're joined by Adama Guy. He is a journalist and author there, Senegalese, former editor of West Africa magazine. He's author of The Dragon and the Ostrich. Adama Guy, thank you very much for joining us today.
My pleasure, Tom, being with you.
You are watching the explosion of Chinese influence and undertakings in Africa. Is this good for Africa? Is this bad for Africa? How do you see it on balance?
I am very, very mixed about this relationship. On the one hand, China appears as a nation that is really willing to engage Africa. It seems willing to take Africa seriously, engaging in relationship at a higher level, as you can see through the visit of President Jintao and other top officials, inviting
yes.
African leaders, and investing heavily in Africa. But on the other hand, indeed, there is a problem, because China put at the center of its approach to Africa the question of sovereignty. It doesn't want to question anything that could be harming African people, that would ultimately be harming African nations. And on the other hand, my biggest worry also is that this is a unilateral relationship whereby only China sets the agenda and Africa seems to be accepting what is coming out from China and not responding in its own approach on the issues on how to tackle the challenge born out of China's Pacific.
China is famous for its policy of non-interference in nations' politics. They don't want interference by outsiders in China, and they say we don't interfere elsewhere. What is the impact of that? Does that mean China becomes an enemy of human rights in Africa, or through economic development, is it through economic means actually helping Africans, even at the level of human rights?
Let's face the reality. China is not helping Africa. I believe that China is pursuing its own agenda. It is presenting itself as the pacifist hyperpower, which is coming out with the nice words. It is, in fact, the champion of public relations today. It is good as soft power, to quote Professor Joseph Nye, saying the nice thing, but in fact, in the practice, on a regular basis, China is doing its business to seek its the security for energy resources it needs from Africa, mineral resources, and ultimately, it's China that is gaining. The bad thing for Africa is that, unfortunately, owing to the bad leadership that Africa has, the kind of leaders that we have in this continent who have been suffering because of the dominance of democratic values, they are rushing toward China in order to find a new tutor. And this is not good ultimately for Africa because the partnership is imbalanced, contrary to what is stated on a regular basis.
We've been joined from Lomé in Togo by West African journalist Adama Guy, author of The Dragon and the Ostrich, about this relationship. We're joined right now as well from Africa, Johannesburg, by Garth LaPere. He's executive director of the Institute for Global Dialogue, author of China in Africa, Mercantilist Predator or Partner in Development. Garth LaPere, thanks very much for being with us.
Hello.
It's good to have you. Adama Guy, joining us from Togo, says, a lot of money here from China. Yes, it's booming, but it's not good for Africa. It's supporting the wrong people and the wrong politics. What do you say?
It has to be seen against the backdrop, you know, of China's global agenda, which I think is driven by three main objectives. The one is access to raw materials. The other is access to markets. And the third is a greater role in international relations for China. And in all of these objectives, I think Africa features quite prominently. So I agree with your two guests, you know, that there's both an upside and a downside to China's engagement in Africa. But I think one has to see this in the broad context of how China has engaged with the continent, say, over the last 40 years. I think it's a combination of expanding its commercial interests, but also balancing this with very close interventions in assisting African countries in areas that would help them to develop. And I think in the latter, China's record is quite impressive and a positive one.
The West's history, of course, dark indeed if you go back far enough, but in recent years, aid from Europe and the EU Africa has come with a lot of strings attached, trying to wring some of the corruption out of China, trying to lean the aid toward positive political development there. But now we're hearing experts saying, you know, the West stands there trying to do that, then China comes with its billions, no strings attached, and ends up supporting the very kind of people and practices that Africa itself and certainly Western donors have tried to get rid of. So does China become a kind of a force throwing us back into the past in that way, Garth LaPere?
I don't necessarily think so. I think there's quite a lot of hypocrisy and duplicity in the Western reading of China's engagement, because if one were to look at the record of aid, if one has to look at the record of development from Western countries, particularly international financial institutions, which pretty much are the standard bearers of Western engagement in Africa, the record is not a very positive one. As a matter of fact, you know, there's very little to show for Western engagement in Africa as far as promoting democracy, human rights, transparency and accountability are concerned. So I think, you know, this is a case of the pot calling the kettle black. The fact of the matter is that China has a basic principle in its foreign policy of non-interference. That principle is practiced very religiously, I would say, in the African context, where China is not concerned with whether a country is democratic or not. I think that has to be taken on its merits. But I think on the ground, one has to look at the record of China's involvement. And I think, broadly speaking, for me, the picture is a positive one. One could certainly identify areas where China's engagement has not been a very healthy one. such as in the Sudan, such as in Zimbabwe, but I would argue that those are probably more the exceptions than the rule.
Mm. Adama Guy in Lomé, Togo, a final thought from you. Garth LaPere in South Africa says, look, the West's record is pretty bad if you look closely at it. China's not worse, and they bring billions with them. So on balance, he's for it. And you?
Listen, I think, Garth, we had this discussion in July, last July, at a conference on the China-Africa issue in Cambridge University, England. But I think that I don't share his opinion. I believe that China needs to be put on hold, make sure that it has to reveal what it wants in Africa, and African people need to define their own agenda instead of expecting any development to come from anybody. Development begins at home, and Africa will achieve its own development. In the past, we expected support from technocratic institutions, the IMF, World Bank, from the former Cold War leaders, USA, or the former Soviet Union, or former colonial powers. It didn't work. It will not work with China also. Africa will have to have its own development, and we have to have our own conversation internally before moving forward. The Chinese do their own things without telling exactly what is going on. They are hiding, and we do not know them exactly. Before, I used to be a solid supporter of China. I'm getting more and more reluctant. The more and more I get to travel to China and meet with Chinese, I'm getting reluctant in supporting this thing unless they change radically and come out clearly in what they want to do with Africans.
Adama Guy in Lomé, Togo, saying put China on hold, but that is tough to do. Mr. Guy, thank you very much for joining us today. Garth LaPere in Johannesburg, please stand by. I want to begin to bring our listeners in, if I may. Bruce is calling from Provincetown, Rhode Island. Bruce, you're on the air.
Good day, Tom. It's Providence. I've been going to Africa for about 10 years now. I've seen the Chinese building roads in Rwanda, harvesting timber in Congo, building stadiums in Mali, and I just wanted to share a reservation that I have about their style of business on the continent. When a Western government institutes an aid project in Africa, one of their goals is generally to raise the local capacity to solve whatever kind of problem they're trying to address.
Okay.
So they want to train local people to do the kinds of jobs that Western experts have been doing in the past.
And what do you see in Chinese projects, Bruce?
Well, the Chinese aren't even trying to do that. You can argue that Western governments haven't really succeeded in building much capacity, but when the Chinese come in, for example, in Mali, there's a sugar mill that the People's Republic built in the mid-1960s. To this day, it is still operated and staffed by Chinese experts who live in their own private compound and are, you know, regularly rotated in from China.
So, but how do you see it on balance, then? I mean, the mill is there. I'm looking here at Time Magazine's report. They're in a Angolan town in the middle of nowhere, a crumbling old railway that's broken down. The Chinese ready to rebuild hundreds or thousands of miles of track, and Angolan there saying, thank you, God, for the Chinese. I mean, whether they run it or not, you've then got the railroad, you've then got the sugar mill.
It's true that they're there, but in the long term, you don't see them helping the Angolans or the Malians learning to run their own railroad or to operate their own sugar mill, and I just think we have to be aware of some of the potential ramifications of that.
Garth LaPere in South Africa, what do you say?
I think the point is extremely well taken. However, I must say that the Chinese are very alive to this criticism. You know, there is a formal organization called the Forum for China-Africa Cooperation, which was established in 2000, and it meets every 3 years to discuss areas of cooperation, to discuss how this can be developed, and to improve, you know, the modes of cooperation that China has with African countries. And I think there is now a realization that what is called this approach of vertical integration, where from engineers, from inputs, technology, labor, and so on, that China has to try and diversify local participation and try and transfer skills as well as technology. And there is now a commitment, I think, by China to try and diversify its portfolio of projects in such a manner that Africans become more more of the partners and the participants in these projects insofar as they become involved in the management of them, insofar as they become, you know, the local beneficiaries of China's investment, and so on and so forth.
You're pretty gung-ho on China. Are you supported by Chinese funds at all, or this is just your straight observation?
This is my straight observation. We are an independent research organization. I hold absolutely no brief for the Chinese. I am very critical of some aspects of China's engagement, and we can discuss those if you have the time. However, I think that one has to look, you know, at both the positive and the negative side of the ledger, which I think should be the purpose of the program. And I'm saying, you know, that that Chinese criticism, African criticism of China's engagement has now, I think, resonated in the corridors of power in Beijing. And through the Forum for China-Africa Cooperation, and an important dimension of the dialogue that takes place here at the political level, in 2006 November, when 44 African heads of state went to Beijing to discuss...
All but five, all but those who recognize Taiwan. That's a huge gathering, yes.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, you know, that's another point we can come to. Only five countries left in Africa that still have relations with Taiwan. So the Chinese have been extremely... strategic and very deliberate in how they've gone about, you know, crafting the Africa diplomacy.
Garth LaPere, let me bring another caller in, if I may. Ismaela is calling from Buffalo, New York. Ismaela, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Good morning.
What do you know?
Tom, I have mixed feelings. I'm from Senegal.
Okay.
And I traveled to Senegal last year, and I realized some of the markets in Dakar have Chinese stores all over the place. It is a good thing to have Chinese come to Senegal and boost the economy and some of the products that they're bringing in. However, the only problem is it's affecting the local tradesmen. And those people have been complaining that some of their products have not been selling because the Chinese are counterfeiting some of the local products and selling them cheaper.
So they're coming in kind of like Walmart, bringing a lot of products, but maybe undercutting some of the locals. But on balance, what do you make of it?
Well, I think that's a problem. That's a problem if the local people are complaining. At first, it was great because the Chinese people have had a good record in helping some of those countries because they have built hospitals, stadiums, and some of the schools that we have in certain villages. But it has come to a point where people are complaining that the Chinese are taking over.
Ismaela, let me ask you, in the long run, do you think Africa will be better off with a heavy Chinese presence or a heavy European/American presence?
Neither one of them. I don't think... I think Africa would be better off if African leaders and African people really start looking at themselves and asking questions as to what needs to be done locally, what kind of training people should be having to help boost the economy.
Yeah, we hear that, but it's hard to resist the billions when they're there. Ismaela, thanks for calling from Buffalo. Garth LaPere in Johannesburg. A last question. What about on the straight-up political side here? China has given a lot of cover to Sudan as the world has looked on what's happened in Darfur. Now, President Hu Jintao is saying he's going to press them on Darfur, but you know, this has been called genocide. Is it China's fault that it's gone on so long?
Look, I think, you know, if one wants to be historically correct, you know, China's engagement with Sudan actually predates Darfur. But that said, I think, you know, there is a serious political problem that China needs to sort out in the sense that China does transfer considerable amounts of arms to the regime in Khartoum, which arms are then used to suppress the rebellion in Western Darfur. And I don't think, you know, that does China's record any good. I think the Chinese, again, are alive to the problem there, but I think, you know, the reality is that they have massive investments in Sudan. They more or less have appropriated huge reserves of oil in the Sudan, which they want to protect. Sudan is a very strategic source of oil. And I think it is rather problematic, you know, that de facto they condone what is happening in the country as far as the human rights and the humanitarian situation is concerned. So it is, I think, something that has blotted their copybook in Africa.
A big mixed picture with a lot of energy in it. You say on balance, glad China's here. Garth LaPere, Executive Director of the Institute for Global Dialogue and author of China in Africa, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Let me go to Hassan calling from Boston. Hi, Hassan. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'd like to make some comments with respect to China's assistance to African countries. Specifically, the money that China gives to African leaders, there are no accountability for the money they give. And as a result, African leaders use such money to suppress and oppress their own people. Examples of such countries have been Guinea in West Africa, where there is the country is actually on the verge of re-evaluation right now. So Chinese assistance to African countries are purely for their own interest. They have never been in the interest of the people. They don't care if they give money to dictators. Whatever use the president make of the money, they don't care about that. So
no strings attached, and in come the billions. Hassan, thanks for your call. Let me turn to New York and Karen Monahan, National Intelligence Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, on leave from the CIA, where she's worked for many years as an analyst of global economic issues. Karen Monahan, thank you for being with us.
Thank you. I'd just like to emphasize that these are my personal views based on my research on increasing Indian and Chinese investment in Africa.
Duly noted. Right up front. Personal views. We've got it. What about the critique we just heard from Hassan? The Chinese come, many billions, no strings attached. He says it empowers dictators.
Well, I think that we need to look at the downside and the upside of China's engagement with Africa. And I think what we need to do is encourage Chinese investment to be responsible and for China to be a responsible stakeholder in terms of their investment and trade. The U.S. should not see China as a threat, but rather encourage China to participate in some bilateral and multilateral initiatives aimed at increasing transparency.
But as things are right now, has Hassan got it right? We should encourage this or that, but as it happens today, is he right? Are Chinese billions working against democracy, working for dictators?
I think it's too early to condemn the Chinese record. I mean, certainly China is investing in infrastructure in many countries, infrastructure that's been neglected for decades, infrastructure that can improve outward trade from Africa and also interregional trade, something that Africa needs to do in order to grow. There is a question about whether their investments in mineral and oil projects are economically sustainable. They don't bring many jobs to locals, and that's something that needs to be addressed.
We've been joined from New York by Karen Monahan, National Intelligence Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, on leave there from the CIA, where she's worked for years as an analyst on economic issues. Right now, Todd is calling from Boston. Hi, Todd. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Very well. What do you know, Todd?
Well, I haven't traveled to Africa, but I've traveled extensively in Southeast Asia and have seen the Chinese influence there. From what I understand, the program's talking about whether there's balance or a possible balance in the long run with Chinese influence as far as businesses and helping out. My experience, what I've seen, is that ultimately there really can't be any balance, even if the Chinese are there to help in the short term. In the long run, what ends up happening is the locals do suffer. Now,
is that any difference with Chinese investment from European or American? Africa's had those footprints there for a long time, and it's not exactly a garden spot.
I would say no. I would say that Chinese investment, no matter where they are, ends up having the same effect, maybe, as Western investment. Now, I'm kind of a cynic sometimes with the West, but I see that in the long run, the only way that a country can help themselves is if the locals step up and not get involved only in politics, but in the financial sector. And I know that's difficult.
Yeah, and the long run can be very long when other people's billions are flying around. Todd, thanks for that. Karen Monahan, what about it? I mean, we read here that the World Bank will look at a project and say, no, this isn't clean enough or right enough for us to do. And then the next day, China does it. No questions asked. So is there a difference when the Chinese money comes in? Or in the long run, is it the same, as Todd suggests?
No doubt we need to avoid what's been called a race to the bottom, where instead of improving standards for environmental human rights, we encourage a race to the bottom of more lax programs. I don't think it's an either-or situation. Mm-hmm. I think that China's on a learning curve, just as Western governments and multilateral institutions have been on learning curves over the last 30 years, learning about how to do development right, how to do development better. And I think the only way that we can accommodate China, and China is a factor. We can't ignore it, and China will continue to be a factor. We need to engage with them both multilaterally and bilaterally, encourage them to sign on to initiatives such as the Extractive Industries Initiative, which encourages transparency in contracts, calls for environmental impact studies. And we also need to encourage African leaders, as Adama Gay was saying, to not be seduced by the money, but to also ask questions about these contracts.
Hard to ask too many questions when the money's so big. Karen, if you'd stand by for a minute. Of course, there's a lot of history to that as well. I want to bring one more voice in from New York, the executive director of the Africa Division of Human Rights Watch. Peter Takirambude is with us. Mr. Takirambude, thank you for joining us. What do you make of China's impact on Africa?
Well, I think it's a mixed report. The report card is mixed in the sense that, as has been stated by other speakers, there is an upside to their presence in Africa. Quite clearly, they have done much to upgrade the infrastructure in several of the countries where they are operating, and they have also there are benefits from trade and investment relationships. Africa, though, counts for only 3% of China's global trade. Actually, China buys 10% of sub-Saharan Africa's exports.
And a huge amount of oil and minerals. So we understand that, and they need that for their economy. What about in your specialty, on the human rights end, is China a net negative there to date?
Well, that's where the downside is, because as other speakers have indicated, the model they have applied in Africa is probably the same model they applied in Asia and places like Burma. The model basically is that in return for access to resources, trade and investment opportunities, the Chinese undertake not to interfere in the internal affairs of the host countries. In other words, the understanding is that you come in, exploit the resources, oil, timber, whatever it is, but in return you see no evil, report no evil, and speak no evil. That's quite imposes quite a high price.
When you look at Darfur in Sudan, how much responsibility for the lingering, long-running death toll there do you put at China's feet?
Well, China is... there are other parties, but China, I think, bears a grave responsibility. I think if it was not for China and, to a certain degree, Russia, I think more progress would have been made in the UN Security Council to respond more robustly to the situation in Darfur. But China has basically vetoed or threatened to veto any major initiative which has teeth.
So building infrastructure all over, threatening a veto on Darfur, and the world has a lot to consider there. Let me go to Nashville, Tennessee, and Mike calling. Hi, Mike. You're on the air.
Hi. I like the discussion, and when you look at track records between Western and Eastern, you know, going into wherever, neither one's too spotless, but
that's for sure.
I think in terms of actually being able to uplift a region or a town or anything.
why do you say that? Because you're a Westerner, do you really think in the long run China's billions and their very active involvement won't have a positive impact?
I'm not saying that they won't, I don't. If a Western or Eastern company goes into Africa and builds railroads, they're going to want something in return either way. But when you look at human rights and, just for instance, AIDS in China, they pretty much won't admit that they do have drug problems and they have an AIDS problem. And
right. Less transparency, but no perfect histories here. Mike, thanks for your call. Let me get one more from Boston. Daniel's on the line. Hi, Daniel. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you doing?
We're good. What do you know, Daniel?
So I'm National Advocacy Director of the Sudan Divestment Task Force. It's a nationwide group that works on getting city, states, and universities to divest their holdings in companies supporting the Sudanese government, including many Chinese oil companies. We currently have legislation in over 20 states.
So you're trying to get American communities to pull their money out of Sudan while China is pouring billions in. What do you make of it?
Yeah, so we advocate a model called targeted divestment. We want to make sure that we don't hurt civilians, so we only divest from companies that are providing revenue to the Sudanese government, because between 70 to 80% of oil revenues go towards the Sudanese military, go towards the genocide in Darfur.
Do China's investments make all your work moot?
Well, we're trying to divest from these Chinese companies to hurt their share price and make them rethink what they're doing. And we've actually had some successes with some European companies that have also been helping the Sudanese government. In the last 2 weeks, ABB and Siemens, which are two large European blue chips that were working in Sudan, have pulled out of the country.
So you're working hard on those. Meanwhile, Chinese investment goes on, though President Hu Jintao says he's going to put diplomatic pressure this time on Sudan. We'll see. Daniel, thanks for calling. Let's get a call from Columbia, South Carolina. We've got Arthur on the line. Hi, Arthur. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom.
Hi.
Tom, I'm just concerned, what all this fuss is all about, you know. Because the Africans themselves, I think the African leaders who are responsible, and I think the bundle of responsibility should be put on the African leaders to be a little more responsible in dealing with the Chinese. But I am not only concerned, but a little suspicious, you know, why, you know, I'm from Liberia, you know, mm-hmm. and after more than 150 years of relationship with the West, specifically America, you mm-hmm. know, my country was involved in a 14-year civil war, and, you know, people were slaughtering one another, and it became, you know, that Africa, the Liberian deal with it is, you know, an internal affairs. And, you know, people just died, and, you know, even recently, before the war came to an end, you know, not much was done. You know, I think the Chinese and African relationship is a new one, and we need to give it time to grow and not just, you know, be speculating on what it's going to lead on to, you know.
Arthur, we hear that loud and clear. It's a strong point. Karen Monahan, Arthur's from Africa, and he looks again at history and says, let's not judge China too quickly here. The West's record has got all kinds of problems in it, and yet we hear the criticism day by day that the Chinese are not holding the same standards as they work forward. It brings us back to the same question, Karen, of you know, does it matter whether the investment comes from this hemisphere or that, this country or that?
You know, during the Cold War, there was a saying that when the elephants fought, the grass suffered. Mm. And I don't think we want to repeat that by battling with China on their efforts to invest in Africa. I repeat that we need to work with them to encourage them to adopt some of the policies that U.S. companies, the U.S. government, the G8, other Western governments have adapted in terms of transparency, human rights, corporate social responsibility, environmental standards. I think it's too early to write off what the Chinese are doing and say that they're just in it to take minerals out. And I think African leaders are becoming aware of this. President Mbeki of South Africa recently said that African leaders needed to avoid repeating a colonialist relationship with China.
Let's go to China for just a moment to check in on that front. We're joined from Beijing by Muir Dickey, Financial Times Beijing correspondent. He's been writing on the issue of Sino-African relations. Muir Dickey, thanks for being with us. Do you see China's attitude toward Africa evolving, changing, or is it just billions in and minerals and oil out?
Well, at the moment, it could be crudely characterized that way, but certainly everything about Chinese politics and diplomacy is in movement. China is not in any sense a settled country. And so I think, as some of your commentators have suggested, there is an interest in Western countries in influencing the way that China engages in Africa. However, obviously, the Chinese are coming from a very different diplomatic background, and they have absolutely no interest in general in promoting what they see as the interference of outside parties in domestic political affairs. Remember, the Chinese tend to feel that they have been targeted by Western countries over issues like human rights, and they have absolutely no interest in looking at other regimes which, like them, do not have a democratic basis and have what Westerners would consider a very patchy record.
I'm reading here in the South China Morning Post very recently a column saying, history may view American foreign policy failures in Central Asia and the Middle East as monuments to a fanatical ideology, one grown from imperial isolationism out of sync with world realities, saying a kind of Chinese perspective saying, why are you trying to push your American ideology on everyone? And yet, that's democracy that we're talking about. Do you imagine, Muir Dickey, China at some point ever beginning to work for democracy alongside its commercial relations, or will it simply leave that to Africa, even African dictators?
Well, certainly, if China continues to be as it is now, an authoritarian communist state, it will have no interest in pushing democracy in Africa. China does often have an interest in stability in the countries with which it does business, and we see that reflected in the rhetoric that surrounded the president who's visit to Sudan. China's talking about assisting the efforts to achieve a resolution of the violence around Darfur. But it's certainly not with a pro-democracy agenda. And until China itself, if China ever does have a democratic state, we certainly can't expect China to be promoting a democratic agenda. I think there is, among the diplomatic community, among these diplomats and scholars, often a sense that Western rhetoric has not been matched by actions for the Western countries, that Western countries have tended to cloak their interests in pro-democratic and human rights rhetoric. And clearly, I suppose, in the last few years, those arguments have been somewhat strengthened by events around the world.
Muir Dickey, with a reality check from Beijing, Financial Times correspondent there, thank you very much for being with us. Peter Takerumbude, so where does this leave Africa? The West came and it was trouble. China's there now with a lot of billions and also some checkered record at the least. Is there a point at which Africa gets free of all the wealth and power interventions from outside, or is it perpetually a pawn in this game?
You know, I think I've had the suggestions that Africa should go its way. But the reality is that Africa cannot do without resources from the international system. I think isolationism is not an option. That will not solve Africa's problem. I think Africa has to remain connected, and Africa has to continue to source investment and trade opportunities from both East and West. I think the crucial issue is the terms of engagement, the rules of engagement between Africa and China, or Africa and the Americans, and Africa and the Europeans.
As Karen Monahan says, exactly, the terms of engagement. And Karen, just a few seconds here, but a final thought. Does the U.S. really have much to say about this anymore? Does it really have much influence, or will it just wait for China to turn and evolve as it will?
No, I don't think it'll wait. The U.S. is involved. The U.S. is talking to Chinese leaders about Africa. The G8 is going to meet later this year, talk about Africa, and engage with the Chinese on this issue as well. There's no standing on the sidelines and waiting. It's part of our foreign policy.
Well, there's a new world of power and power projection here and a lot to watch. We're grateful to both of you for being with us. Karen Monahan at the Council on Foreign Relations on leave from the CIA with her personal views. Karen, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And Peter Takerumbude, Executive Director of the Africa Division of Human Rights Watch. Mr. Takerumbude, thank you for being with us today.
Thanks, Tom.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.